the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
This morning we speak first with Summit Land Conservancy's conservation leadership interns, Lauren Page and Alana McClements. They'll talk about the science of saving land and how their summer internship landed them jobs. Then we'll talk about what it would be like to surf the rings of Saturn or golf on the moon with the author of the new book, Daydreaming in the Solar System, Surfing Saturn's Rings, Golfing on the Moon, and Other Adventures in Space Exploration. That all coming up this hour on Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
This morning, we welcome to the studio Summit Land Conservancy's conservation leadership interns, Lauren Page and Alana McClements. They join us to talk about what they did over the summer to help Summit Land Conservancy save land. As we all know, Summit Land Conservancy is Park City's local accredited land trust dedicated to saving the lands of the Wasatch Back. And they've worked with willing landowners to place these permanent conservation easements on their property. Well, Lauren and Alana, welcome to Cool Science Radio. We can't wait to hear more about what you did.
Sweet. Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, let's start with both of your backgrounds. Because you both have really interesting backgrounds in both education and sort of your experience and your come from. So, Lauren, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, so I was born and raised here in Utah, great place to grow up. I graduated from the University of Utah with a Bachelor of Science in Environmental and Sustainability Studies with a focus on some geology and geography studies.
You mention field research on paleoclimates.
Yes.
With the use of GIS mapping. What's a paleoclimate?
Yeah, so paleo, ancient, old climates, you know, your weather, your patterns throughout long periods of time. So I studied basically ancient weather climates and patterns over time, and my focus region was in the Andes Mountain of Colombia.
Well, great. So when you talk to someone at, you know, you go home for Christmas and your parents have a party and you're talking to people about what you do and they all want to know what you know, your general impressions are having looked at climate situations over millennia, what do you say?
You know, you say it's obviously ongoing, evolving throughout time. We are here in a minute period of time, right? The Earth is so ancient and so old. And so obviously climate is ongoing and evolving and changing, but we are kind of key contributing factors right now here at the present. Like, humans are truly making an impact and difference, so we have to be mindful of that.
So, Alana, tell us about your background, because when we were talking before the show, you said that you went to Dartmouth, so you're obviously not from Utah.
Yeah. I grew up in Boulder, Colorado, and I received a BA in Environmental Earth Sciences from Dartmouth, and I moved to Park City right after I graduated to ski patrol.
Perfect. So you both are working with the Summit Land Conservancy under the Conservation Leadership Internship. Tell us about this, because it seems like this is a pretty big deal. Well, I'll start with you, Lana. Lauren, let's start with you on that.
Yeah, so I had a great experience working as the internship. In the role itself, you kind of work across the different teams at Summit Land Conservancy, which is the outreach teams, conservation team, and stewardship teams. So kind of experience all three of those factors to get an overall experience of like what a land trust looks like.
Nice. And then, Alana, what was your role and your focus with your internship?
Yeah, pretty similar to Lauren. So she was the intern last summer, and I was the intern this past summer. And I did a lot of stewardship work during my internship, which actually helped me get the role that I'm in right now, which is a more stewardship-facing role. Lauren is more conservation-focused in her job. So I was out in the field a lot of days. I was monitoring our conservation easement properties, because when we protect a property, we have to make sure that we are protecting it forever. So we need to monitor each property annually to make sure that the landowner is upholding their part of the agreement.
And so, Alana, what does stewardship involve? You say that the landowners are upholding their part of the agreement, which would be, I think most times when you conserve or when you put a conservation easement on a piece of land and you allow the landowner to continue, say, grazing their animals or, I don't know, what are some of the other things?
Yeah, absolutely. So each of our easements is different, right? We work with the landowner on Lauren's side of things to make sure that we have an agreement that works for them in the way that they want to use the land. So if they want to keep grazing, we can make that happen. If it's a land piece that's used for public recreation, we make sure that that can continue to happen. And then on the stewardship side of things, we go out every year to each of our properties and we monitor the property to make sure that there's no concerning areas of change. So we focus especially on human-related areas of change. So, you know, whether there's a new structure and whether that structure was allowed to be built or not allowed to be built, whether there's a new trail, whether that was permitted or not. How are the waterways doing is something we look at. How's the ecological health in general?
It is so complex, and I think the general public really has no idea of all of these things, especially, you know, it's one thing to conserve land, but the stewardship and the complexities of that, can you think off the top of your head of anything that, you know, the public would never have an idea of in terms of stewardship and what happens to the land afterwards? And I guess, you know, if maybe something comes to mind immediately, but what comes to mind for me is, you know, these growing pressures about recreation on these lands that we have conserved, and then things like parking and stuff like that comes up that may change how you approach it with stewardship.
Yeah, absolutely. And we definitely recognize that the changing uses of land is something that we need to work with landowners on as well. So we try to build in some flexibility into the initial agreement so that, you know, if they need to make a parking area in a certain part of the conservation easement, they're able to do that if we set that up in advance. Something that I think have found that really alters our landscapes is actually spring flooding. So last spring we were out there on our properties. Brett Denny, the stewardship manager, was out there just making sure that our trails weren't washing away and that we weren't having to do a lot of like letting landowners know that their infrastructure was being hurt. So we're just out there checking on the properties and making sure that nothing is changing for the worse and that the ecological integrity is maintained.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Lauren Page and Alana McClements. They have been the conservation leadership interns with the Summit Land Conservancy. Well, Lauren, let's talk about the science of land conservancy because we, you know, as residents, we see the land. It's a beautiful thing. We think there's got to obviously be some environmental benefits. But truly, what are some of the other ecological important reasons to save these lands?
Yeah, so we kind of look at all things when you're going over a piece of property. What we look at are the conservation values, right? These values are really what kind of outline the conservation easement as a whole. And those things can include, you know, your overall things you think of, habitat, recreation, open space, and then you can get kind of more into the nitty-gritty. You can get into like agricultural productions is truly a conservation value that we keep in mind. You know, habitat health of wildlife species is key. You know, when we're looking at getting funding sources for these conservation easement properties, we're looking at what state level and federal levels care about. You know, in this region, sage grass is a really key species that is important protecting. So we look at those values when looking at the health. Something I do in my job is that I utilize ArcGIS Pro, which is a mapping software program for those unfamiliar. And that's a great program that I can utilize to kind of look at these values and things, right? I can look at the ecological profile of the space. I can look at the geology and the past history of like what happened millions of years ago, you know, the hydrology of what's happening in this area and what the watershed is doing.
So with these land easements and conservation easements that Summit Land Conservancy and other groups have done, have you been able to see, just in your short time being with the Summit Land Conservancy, a significant increase in the health of these lands that have been saved?
Yeah, I mean, you require kind of long-term scale to look at those impacts. And I think part of that and something that's like key is land trust work is so important in what we do. And with that, our main job is to put land on a conservation easement, right? That's what we can do. And to further that, like, we work with project partners across the region to further utilize making sure that land is as healthy as it can be, right? So we work with project partners like Sageland Collaborative, with Beaver Dam Analogs. We work with an organization called Three Springs Land and Livestock. They're a local regenerative ranch, and they do a lot of work with us in the Camas Valley to test the soils there, right? See where the carbon capture storage is. Make sure that the health is being maintained on the land, not just that it's conserved in the first place.
Something that is striking me as we're talking to you, Lauren, and you, Alana, is that you already sound like seasoned professionals. And so I'm wondering, wow, this was an amazing internship, or you already had so much knowledge coming into it. I mean, any organization would be very lucky to have the level of expertise that you already have, that that you're able to articulate and talk about. It's really amazing. So, Lauren, maybe you could just address that a little bit. You know, how much of this did you all already know about, and how much have you learned through doing this?
Sure, yeah, I appreciate that. So we both come from science backgrounds, right? We both have an interest in the environment, heavily caring for it, stewarding it. And I think at a place like Summit Land Conservancy, it's such a great environment of people who love the land, right, and want to do this. So with that, like, we learn so much experience both out in the field of how to deal with these properties. You know, I didn't know what a land trust was really before I started working there, right? So I had the science background, but like through working at this job, you learn how to apply those skills and the knowledge to where it really matters, right? Yeah. Like, where is really showing up in the community? How am I actually using my knowledge and my skills to make a difference in the area?
Yeah.
So it fosters a passion for it, right? You take the skills, and a job like this helps you grow even further in it.
Right. Alana, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, absolutely. That was very kind. Thank you. And I think something that really makes this internship so unique is that you're able to work on such a small team. Summit Land Conservancy isn't that big, so you're able to work really closely with all of the amazing leaders at Summit Land. You're able to work really closely with the outreach leaders, the stewardship leaders, the conservation leaders, and you're able to kind of dip your toes into each of these teams in Summit Land Conservancy and really get a sense of exactly what each team does. So you get a really broad sense of what the whole organization is doing and your place in that. And then Lauren and I were able to kind of choose where we felt our skills best applied, and we were able to kind of dive deeper into that work towards the end of our internships, which was really powerful.
Well, Alana, let's get back to the Camas Valley. I was reading that in 2023, the Camas Valley was designated as Grasslands of Special Significance. Tell us more about that. That sounds like a really cool thing, and I never would have thought of the Camas Valley as having that kind of significance.
Yeah, it's really cool. The Camas Valley is actually home to a really rare type of soil. It's called the Todspan loam series. And it's a really loamy soil, which makes it really good at both holding water and not getting too waterlogged. It's a great agricultural soil. So we were able to work with the state conservationist a few years ago to get this designation of Grasslands of Special Significance because of this loam series. And that actually helps us protect land more effectively in that area because we've designated it as really important land. So we've actually been awarded over $20 million for our work in the Camas Valley since we got that designation, which is really exciting.
Well, Lauren, let's get back to the idea of the regenerative grazing. Is that what you call it? Tell us more about that, because I think a lot of people make that assumption that you see cows out in the field and, oh, that's not a good thing to have. But really, we're finding if done right, it can be a big benefit to the local ecology and the environment. So tell us more about that.
Yeah, so that's really where our partners, Three Springs Land and Livestock, come into play, right? We were able to actually host an event with them earlier this summer and be on their ranch and kind of see the work that they do. And they were able to kind of give us a demonstration of soils. They had kind of a soil column from land that was kind of more barren and not really under any proper management, and then they had a soil column that was under their management. And you could see they poured water on both of these soil columns, and you could see how much of an impact that made of, like, kind of the bare soil of the water just dripping through that immediately, running off quickly, no water retention, nothing retained, versus the management that they did. You could really see how that stayed within the soil column and had, like, better beneficial properties. And so the Camas Valley is kind of designed to do that, right? And the way it's set up and shaped to do. And so as long as the management is proper on those places, it works perfectly with the valley, right? It's designed to do that. It keeps the agricultural well-being met, it keeps the hydrology met, you know, and that ultimately feeds the overall watershed with the Weber River and, you know, all the way down to the Great Salt Lake. So these impacts have trickle effects on a much larger scale.
I'm wondering if you were able to, during your internship, sort of see the appetite of these landowners who are maybe, you know, cattle ranchers, increase to put conservation easements on their land. I mean, it seems like until we knew about regenerative grazing, is that what we call
agriculture,
it? Agriculture, that they would have thought, well, you know, this farm, this ranch has been in my family for generations, and if we just take all the cattle off of it, is that something I really want to do? How does it change the appetite, do you think, and the interest in conservation?
Yeah, I think there's a huge interest right now in private landowners to be doing this work. You know, I think 10 years ago, Summit Land Conservancy was primarily focused on open space, recreational things in your local area.
Yeah.
And now, as we're looking forward, all the current projects and things we're working on really are kind of those private landowners who want to see their legacy maintained. You know, they want to keep these rangelands in their family, and they want it to be working for them. They don't want to give this land to their, you know, kids, grandkids, et cetera, and have it be failing for them, right? So not only do they have an interest to conserve the land and put it under easement, but they also want to work at making sure that it is sustainable, that it is healthy, that they have a means of funding that property for generations to come.
Yeah. And so, Alana, as you go into your stewardship with this, is it ongoing sort of education for these ranchers to, you know, help maintain this loamy soil in the Camas Valley? And, you know, how much work is it? How much education is there? And then in turn, you know, how much do you have to keep up on the current research about this kind of agriculture?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we try to provide good resources for our landowners. You know, if they want to build a new fence, we try to figure out with them how to do that in a way that's going to be best for the wildlife. Or if they want to take an area out of irrigation, we want to figure out with them how best not to make that area just come back as really weedy and like a negative piece of land on their property. So we want to be there as resources for them to help them maximize the ecological benefits and kind of get what they want out of their property. So we kind of work, mostly they approach us with that sort of thing, and then we try to give them the best information they can possible. But yeah, Brett and I work really hard to make sure that we're kind of up on the best restorative techniques, especially for riparian areas. We're kind of working on a riparian restoration project right now, and yeah, we just want to make sure that we are well equipped to let the landowners know that we can help them out with anything that they might need.
I think a program like this is such a great example of the diversity of science fields that can all come together and work towards a common goal. So this is a question for both of you. Lauren, I'll have you answer it first. When you were doing your studies and finishing up your undergraduate degrees, did you foresee yourselves working for an organization like Summit Land Conservancy? Because we found out before the start of the show that you're both still working with them, so lucky us. So Lauren, did you see yourself doing something like this as you were completing your studies?
You know, not initially. I definitely thought I was going to be more solidly in a research, in a lab, kind of day-to-day of my life, because I had interest in that. But I always kind of had this battle or this urge to really be kind of in the current policy public sectors, right? Part of this radio show itself, right, is like making science accessible, and I feel super strongly about that. So I wanted to be in an area where I could do kind of current work, apply it to the community, and have the community care about it, right? Like, I'm such a STEM and science person, but those things only work when your community cares about it.
So, and Alana, did you see yourself ending up in this kind of position as you were finishing your undergrad?
Yeah, it was definitely something that I was thinking about. I think something that I came out of my undergrad with was just this extreme desire to want to be out in the field in my work. That was my favorite part of all my courses and my field study program in college. I just loved being outside and, you know, the one tromping around through the stream in the fields, taking the data, figuring that sort of thing out. I just really wanted to be on the ground doing the work. But I also studied English in college, and I really love to write and communicate. So similarly to Lauren, actually, we both have this interest in science communication. And I felt through some other just, you know, field work programs that I wasn't able to access that other part where it was, I wasn't able to think about how to communicate what I was doing to a broader audience and to make people really care about it. And that was something that was really appealing about the internship, is that it had this outreach component too. So I was on the ground, I was doing the research, I was in the field, but I was also able to go on community hikes and tell people in the community what I was doing and explain to them why it's important and why they should care about the work that Summit Land Conservancy is doing. So it really, this role just filled a perfect niche that I kind of didn't know existed, but I was hoping did after I graduated from college.
It's so great. And as you were talking and talking about how, you know, you were an English major and you love to write, unfortunately, the first thing that popped into my mind was grant applications. I mean, it's not very creative, but it's so necessary. And to have been awarded over $20 million for this work in the Camas Valley, someone did some really fancy writing. Right? And how much will that play in your new role?
Yeah, absolutely. It's really important to know how to sell the work that you're doing, right? Because if you can't, even if it's important and you can't articulate why to anyone else and make them care, you can't do anything in a vacuum by yourself. You need to know how to ask for help, whether that's money, whether that's collaboration. So yeah, I think that's something that everyone at Summit Land Conservancy understands really well. And you know, the whole team is actually a great group of writers. Yeah. And we all kind of work on reviewing each other's work and reviewing each other's grant applications. And our communications director just does an amazing job on the website as well. So I have a lot of great role models at Summit Land to look up to as I'm kind of learning how to grant write. And so I'm really looking forward to kind of taking more of that on.
That's great.
And
you know, also we, you know, sage people with all this experience and this wisdom, and that your role models at Summit Land Conservancy can learn a lot from the younger generation. I find that constantly, because you all have been raised in a different environment, you know, a different way of learning, different technology, different. And so it's really enriching. Lauren, you said something a couple minutes ago that made me wonder about, well, you said land conservation and conservation easements used to be about just what you weren't going to build and having open space, and people who donate to land conservation, a lot of times it's all about like, I got here, now I don't want anything else built. And so what kind of, you know, what have you discovered in that realm since you've been, you know, working with Summit Lands, in terms of, you know, getting the people to come along, those who are giving money to say like, yeah, we're going to conserve it, but then it means that you might not be able to use it like you want to as well.
Right, absolutely. When we're asking for private donations from people, right, it's not always going to go to your Round Valley, your McPullen Farm, a place that you get to recreate, right? It sometimes is going to a private landowner who has a beautiful piece on the river, like Weber River, that you're not going to be able to fish in, right? And I think you have to understand that as a point of, as a human, if we, you know, really care about the environment and these things, right? We care about the overall well-being, and you want your future generations, your kids, your friends, your family to enjoy these spaces. It's about kind of making those sacrifices here and there, right? I'm saving this piece of land or helping save this piece of land that I'm not going to have access to, and that's okay.
Yeah.
Because it's not always about your access. It's about, you know, making sure that the habitat that lives there has that access, right? We come second, more or less, right? And like, that's kind of a hard pill to swallow. And I understand, like, for the donors who donate, that is hard to sometimes not have that access, but that's the sacrifice that you're making to make sure that generations to come can still enjoy those ecosystem services.
Well, one final question. I'm gonna direct this to Alana. As we are out enjoying our natural lands, whether it's an easement or it's on the trails, probably more this spring than right now, what can we look for to be our own conservation, ecologically minded, you know, land users? What would you say to go out and notice around us?
Yeah, I think just general mindfulness of your surroundings. I think I've really learned through my work at Summit Land Conservancy to pay attention when I'm out on the trails and to think about, you know, oh, is this trail new? Just noticing those little things. Is this trail new? Like, oh, I haven't seen that type of bird here before. What is it? That patch of thistles looks a little worse than last year. I wonder why that is. Was it a drier year? I think just that way of like thinking really purposefully about your surroundings, and instead of just plugging in your headphones and going on your jog, really taking it all in, I think that really heightens all of our appreciation of the natural world. And it's a really good exercise. And that's something that I really love about my job, is just getting to have those moments where I'm really focused on my surroundings. I think that's something we don't do enough these days.
Yeah. Well, before we let you go, there will be another search for two more incredible interns for next summer. Lauren, can you just briefly go over what the requirements are, and if someone's listening now that may like to apply?
Yeah, absolutely. So the conservation leadership intern is someone, you know, that has a science background, is recently graduated or graduating from college, cares about open space, cares about protecting their community, and just interested in the land trust world and wants to learn more about it.
Excellent. Well, Lauren and Alana, this has been a great conversation. We're so glad that you could join us here on Cool Science Radio, and best of luck. We'll be seeing you around town.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Thank you so much. Great to meet you both.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Many of us in Park City have golfed on an exclusive course, or we have rappelled into a slot canyon or down a mountain face. Maybe we were surfing off the Big Island or sailing the Pacific. But we here have been able to do quite a large number of exciting sports and have had grand adventures. But I can guarantee you that none of us have golfed on the far side of the moon or surfed Saturn's rings. And I'm pretty sure no one has rappelled into one of Mars' many deep canyons. Unfortunately, none of us will ever get to do these things. But that doesn't mean we can't daydream about it. Here to help us imagine these exotic adventures is the science advisor to the president of the Canadian Space Agency, John Moores, who, along with author Jesse Rogerson and illustrator Michelle Parsons, has written a new book, Daydreaming in the Solar System: Surfing Saturn's Rings, Golfing on the Moon, and Other Adventures in Space Exploration. John, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
We've all read the books, and Lynn and I have interviewed many authors that have talked about the experiences on other planets and other, you know, worlds and within the solar system, but none of them really talked about the adventures we could have. Why is it that you guys chose this route?
Well, we were looking for something out there in science communication that we couldn't really find. We wanted to combine together these absolutely correct, you know, this absolutely correct information we have about the solar system and what an amazing place it is. But we wanted something also that went and grabbed the reader the way that science fiction does. And we wanted to put these together in an interesting and an engaging way. And when we looked at what was out there, the science fiction was great, but even the stuff that tries to get the solar system right does take liberties here and there to make the plot a bit more exciting. And when you're looking at people talking about the space missions that have gone out, you know, that doesn't always, you know, get the reader in quite the same way. There's not that sense of involvement. It's a little bit at a remove sometimes. You know, sometimes I think, you know, as scientists, we're used to seeing things on a lab bench and interrogating them as separate for us. And we wanted to dissolve that boundary in what we were doing.
So what kind of data do you have to look at to understand the mechanics of being able to, say, surf on Saturn's rings?
Well, the nice thing is that we've actually had spacecraft that have visited these places. So we've got a lot of information that's come back, a lot of different kinds of data. It's very different from the five senses that human beings have, but there's enough there that you can kind of piece it back together a little bit. You know, we have information on, you know, the different types of molecules and atoms that make up a lot of the planetary surfaces, what kinds of gases are in their atmosphere. And using that kind of information, we can imagine, you know, here's what it might smell like, or here's what it would taste like, or, you know, feel like to be in a place like that. And, you know, even simple things are different. I love that. One of my favorite parts of the book is we make coffee on Titan. And just a simple thing every day, we all do it, many of us do anyway. And what we've imagined is, you know, how would that experience be? And we thought back to thinking about flying in airplanes, where you have to add a lot of extra salt and a lot of extra sugar and fat to make things palatable because your senses are deadened because the pressure is low and the humidity is low. But on a place like Titan, where there's more pressure, 1.5 times as much as there is here on the Earth, we wondered, you know, would your senses be heightened? You know, would it be, you know, a very different experience? And I actually ran into somebody the other day who had some experience eating food in hyperbaric chambers, and they confirm, actually, it does work like that.
That's so great. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with John Moores, who has co-written a book called Daydreaming in the Solar System, and he is a science advisor to the president of the Canadian Space Agency. John, I would love to just ask you a little bit about that position and how you became the science advisor to the president of the Canadian Space Agency, whose name I don't even know at this point. Maybe you could share that with us.
Actually, that's a position I no longer hold. I recently retired from public service and I'm back in the academic sector now. You know, that was a really exciting job to have. The president of the Canadian Space Agency is Lisa Campbell. And one of the wonderful things about it, I always like pushing my boundaries out a little bit. So I'm originally trained as a space engineer and as a planetary scientist, actually not that far from where you are down in Arizona is where I did my grad work. And, you know, one of the nice things about that particular job with the space agency is that the space agency works in a number of different domains. There's engineering, there's space exploration to planets, but also astronomy and also Earth observation, what the astronauts do, so human exploration. And I got to be a part of all of it and to make sure that science was included wherever we chose to go and explore. And that was just an amazing experience, I have to say, to sort of, you know, see how that works from the public side of the public service side of things.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, going back to Titan and the increased pressure and that creating sharper senses, possibly the sense of taste, that's a really interesting fact. And nothing that we would have thought twice about had you not brought into it that if we made coffee on Titan, that we probably wouldn't need as much sugar and cream. Can you tell us why greater pressure creates higher sensitivity in the senses?
That's a good question. I will admit I'm not someone who, you know, knows all that much about human biology. But I know that a lot of chemical reactions do happen more quickly at higher pressure and higher temperature. So I would speculate that it's related to that.
Okay, that's a good one. And just to make a point there, maybe more than anything, is that these kinds of stories that you're bringing forth and these kind of metaphors and comparisons about what it would be like in the solar system, I think is a really good way to get people to relate more to what's going on out there with space travel, because it is this unrelatable thing. We don't know what it's like, and we can read about these various missions, but until you bring up these specific kinds of comparisons, it doesn't really hit home. So kudos to you on that.
Thank you very much. It was a fascinating journey for Jesse and I, because as professional scientists, often you don't think about how these things would appear to a human being. What's the human scale on this sort of thing? We ended up doing a lot of calculations actually to support, you know, what it was we were talking about in the book, and discovered some interesting things, you know, amidst data that's been known for years. So we really enjoyed doing that.
Well, let's get to a couple of specific adventures that you could have in our solar system. One is rappelling into Valles Marineris.
Valles Marineris, yes.
Okay, so rappelling into the Valles Marineris on Mars. I know myself and a lot of us have been rock climbers and mountain climbers throughout our lives, maybe not so much anymore. So we've all had that experience of rappelling, like I said, off of a mountain face or into a slot canyon. What would be different about doing that on Mars, other than the fact that these are incredibly deep canyons?
It's true. You have something like 10,000 vertical meters here that you're going down. So it's a bit of a journey. There are advantages to being on Mars. You only have 1/3 the gravity. So your ropes and your climbing equipment can be a lot more slender than what you have on the earth. You don't have as much, you know, felt weight to actually, you know, support. But you do have some challenges as well. Got to have a space suit. Otherwise, you know, it's not going to end well for the protagonist. And you've got to bring, you know, not just your food and your water, but you need to bring your air with you as well. That's the other main challenge.
Okay, so let's talk about prospecting on Venus's surface, because a lot of us love to look for rocks and crystals while we hike around here. I know it's not the same thing as prospecting, but let's say you survive the air pressure or the, you know, the atmospheric pressure of Venus. What would that entail?
So Venus, while we were writing the stories, we realized this is the Jules Verne planet, because you've got the balloons up high, you know, in another one of our stories, and then down low, you've got these kind of more deep sea diving type of suits to keep out that 90 times as, you know, thick atmosphere as you have on the Earth with that higher pressure. But the temperature is the thing that's really challenging down there. Just thinking about that, you know, we don't really have good ways of rejecting, you know, that heat and keeping it away from a human being. And the best ways of doing it tended to focus on bringing something with you, a cube of something like wax, and putting all the heat into that, letting it melt. And then once it's melted, then your time's up. So it's not actually governed by, you know, how long you could explore is not governed by, you know, the pressure or the air that you bring with you. It's actually how long you can keep the heat at bay. But at the same time, there are advantages to being down in that environment. Because the air is thick, you can actually fly around and move that way. It does take a little effort to push through the atmosphere, though not as much as we expected. And you can't see all that far. It's a little like being underwater. It's something, you know, in between, you know, being, you know, on a desert plain and being underwater in terms of how far you can see, probably a you know, maybe 1,000 feet or so before it starts to get hazy and murky. And it's just such a fascinating place, because as we're learning more about Venus, and especially the higher elevations, we're seeing these as being remnants of a planet that doesn't exist anymore, a vanished Venus that might have been wet and clement to life the way that early Earth was.
Yeah, so I'm wondering, when we talk about how to repel heat on, you know, for example, on Venus, if our human species were to actually ever make it there, you know, it's so interesting to read about the heat shield on various spacecraft and how they repel it. Where are we in terms of transferring that kind of technology from those heat shields on a spacecraft to being able to employ them if we were to, say, travel to Venus and have a space suit that could repel the heat?
Yeah, the challenge is the timing. When you're coming into a planetary atmosphere, the heat is really intense, but it's really short. So if you have a good insulator, and if you have something that, you know, can melt, and we call it a blade of shielding, because what happens is it essentially melts and ionizes and then takes the heat away from the spacecraft. That you're only doing for a few minutes. But on the surface of Venus, you've got that heat that wants to seep in. And repelling that for a long time is a hard thing to do. I mean, we use something similar, or the proposals are to use something similar, like, you know, that block of wax that melts, or something else that melts and absorbs the heat. But it's a difficult place even for machines to operate. I mean, most of the proposals that I've seen have been arguing for maybe a couple of hours, even for machines, before they overheat. So it's a real challenge. A lot of these places we go and explore, the challenge of getting there and of doing things is not the technology, it's the fragile human being inside that you need to protect and keep in good working order.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, that's a really interesting concept. Plans you've seen about wax. Did you say absorbing the heat? Mm-hmm. That I never would have thought. I mean, obviously, you have a candle that's a wax candle with heat, and I've never pondered that the reason that the wax is there, in part, is because it can absorb the heat and help burn. How bizarre! And what do those plans look like?
Well, it's a strange environment to operate. So I'm hopeful some of these, you know, come to fruition. We've started making plans, in planetary science to explore the upper atmosphere of Venus. And there's a couple of missions that are hoping to go in the next decade or two after really not being much activity on Venus for quite some time. It's been a while. We've had the European Venus Express mission, of course, and Akatsuki from Japan, but also from the US side of things, the last spacecraft to visit the planet was Magellan, I believe 1990. So, you know, getting down to the surface again, that would be wonderful. The only people that have been there have been the, you know, the Soviet Union. And even they only got a few minutes before the conditions became too difficult for that that machine.
So, John, in addition to the research that you did for this book that included all of the conditions in these different on these different planets and within our solar system, you talk about, like we said, golfing, rappelling, trekking, surfing, sailing. Did you also get to go out and hone those skills as well to make sure that you were accurate in this book?
Oh, wouldn't that have been lovely? So some of it just comes from the experience that that Jesse and I have. You know, for me, I'm somebody who knows how to sail. So that was very, you know, near and dear to my heart. To my knowledge, neither of us surfs, although it would be a very different experience on the, you know, in the rings of Saturn. It's still governed by gravity. So it's got some similarities, but a lot of differences as well. And a lot of the other experiences that we have, thinking about being out in nature, experiencing that awe and the, you know, that overwhelming sense of the sublime, you know, it comes from things like that. Jesse was an avid camper in his earlier days. And when I was studying for my planetary science degree, we would often take field trips throughout the Southwest and spend time, you know, out in that raw nature. And that's one thing I think that we've tried to have come across in the book. So a lot of the science fiction that's out there, and even the science fiction that's oriented towards science communication, tends to be that, you know, very dramatic, exciting, you know, the first time anyone has ever seen this particular place or been in this particular area. We wanted to make it less, you know, overall big, you know, exclamation mark, exploration, discovery, more like personal discovery and personal exploration. So you can think of it as people going out to a national park. And if you're going out to a national park, often you're doing that you're going to do something physical out there, whether that's, you know, paddling down a rapid or, you know, going for a hike or climbing a mountain or something like that. And one of the nice things I think about that particular perspective is that you can really be in nature and you can take it all in the way that an initial explorer might be more concerned about, you know, like, oh, you know, how am I going to get through this day? And I hope that rock doesn't fall on me. And, you know, you're not as present, I think, when you've got that kind of goal versus, you know, the way that we go out and experience something like a national park.
Well, let's keep talking about hiking or trekking. And I want to say thank you for including Mercury, because so often when people write about the solar system, poor little Mercury gets just left over there because it's just hot and close to the sun. But you talk about trekking Mercury's Crust of Dawn Trail. All right, what is the Crust of Dawn? And I'm assuming there's not a trail there, but what would that be like?
Yeah, this is an interesting story. And in talking about it with others, it seems to have really, really connected. What we did here is we used the strange orbital dance that Mercury does, in that it essentially goes around on its own axis. So it's day, it goes around twice, it goes around three times, while the planet goes around the sun twice. And, you know, you might think, okay, then the day is like 2/3 of the year, but it turns out that this kind of dance keeps, you know, the sun facing side actually moves very, very slowly. So it takes two full years to watch the sun go all the way through the sky and come back to the same place again. So that gives you 176 days if you're on Mercury to do something. And we imagined, well, is that enough time to walk all the way around the planet? So we set something up and it turns out that, yes, you can do that in 176 days. You don't want to do it in the middle of the day because the sun is 2.6 times bigger in the sky, and it heats everything around to self-cleaning oven temperatures, which is not good. And, you know, night is nice. Definitely that would be more relaxed. But we were thinking, okay, if you were a trekker and you were trying to, you know, push the boundaries a little bit, what you would probably want to do is get a little bit of sunlight so you could see the terrain, but not so much that you cook. And so dawn is what we were thinking of. And we're thinking of things like the Pacific Crest Trail, you know, these long hikes that people do over months. And there's actually, you can take about 10,000 kilometers or so, make it all the way around. We thought the 60 degree north parallel was the most interesting spot. And we had someone walk all the way around the planet being chased by the sun. And that element of being chased by the sun, we thought was very evocative, because you could elect to spend more time in a particular area, get to know it a little bit better, get a little bit, you know, more sunlight there, but eventually you have to move on. You can't double back. You can't, you know, say, okay, I'm going to savor this experience later on. You have to do everything in the moment as you're going around. So it was a lovely metaphor.
And, let's just hope that no one trips and sprains their ankle and can't move on, because planning for midday sun when it is self-cleaning oven temperature is, yeah, but how fun to imagine. Okay, I'm a horrible golfer. You know, my drive might be about 100 yards as, you know, on a good day, which really means I'm not a golfer at all, but I'm going to have a lot better luck if I golf on the moon. How so?
Oh, that's the wonderful thing. The gravity is so low there that if you hit the ball with the same power and accuracy as you do on the Earth, it'll travel much, much further. You actually get this advantage from being in this different environment.
So what is that different environment? Is it lesser atmosphere? Is it less gravity? What is really affecting that drive of that little golf ball?
It's both of those things. Once you hit the ball, it doesn't have to, you know, push any air out of its way, so it can travel further that way. And it's going to come back down to the surface much more slowly with the 1/6 gravity that we have on the moon. So you have the potential for, you know, hitting it much further, as long as you've got a spacesuit that is sufficiently flexible and equipment that is, you know, tuned to the environment. There was a little reanalysis of Alan Shepard, who brought sort of a makeshift club up on, what was it? I'm going to get the number wrong. I want to say it's Apollo 14, but, you know, he brought up some golf clubs or it was based on a modified digging tool and some golf balls and hit a few drives as NASA said later, for the fun of it. So, you know, this was an approved activity and all of that. And I think there's a few apocryphal stories of them going, you know, miles and miles, but it really only went a few hundred feet. And that's mostly because the Apollo spacecraft, their suits, we're not really designed to do things like that require, you know, really quick, dexterous motions.
All right, well, let's talk about Europa. Europa's been the subject of a number of sci-fi books. I think it was 2001 or 2010, Space Odyssey. The sci-fi based on Europa and what is actually, let's just say, growing below the ice or living below the ice. Actually, there's a space mission going out there now. What would it be like to be beneath the Europa ice? And could we do that in a scuba diving suit, or would you need a special submersible?
Yeah, you'd need a special submersible. There's enough pressure there that you're going to need essentially a deep sea diving kind of rig to go down there, just from the weight of the ice. Even though the gravity is less and that weight, that pressure accumulates less quickly, the European Ocean is so deep. I mean, the guesses are, you know, of order 100 kilometers perhaps, that you're going to need that extra protection to survive down there.
Before we let you go, I want to ask you about your illustrator, Michelle Parsons. Tell us about her, because she's got these really fun descriptive illustrations throughout the book.
Absolutely. So Michelle is a science illustrator and a nature journalist. And we invited her to come on board and to think about some of these things from space, and to bring that that nature journaling kind of perspective with her. So we have some lovely diagrams throughout the book to help us tell the story of the science, because, you know, picture's worth at least 1,000 words, I think. And also, after each story, she read those and then put together a watercolor painting, you know, how it is that she imagined it. So we end up then sort of with this interesting dialogue between, you know, my stories, Jesse's science, and Michelle's painting. And in some cases, the story inspired the science, others the science inspired the story. And there's cases where, you know, the painting as it was coming together inspired Jesse and I to, you know, change up what we were doing. But it's kind of like a little bit of a jump start. We want everyone to imagine in their own mind's eye being there on this environment. But having that nice soft watercolor vision there, you know, might get some people started.
Okay, I know one more final question for you. Of all the places you talk about going and all the adventures you talk about having, which one would you really love to do?
Oh my, it's like, you know, choosing between all of your children in some ways. Yeah, they're all fascinating. I think my favorite is the ballooning on Venus one. The idea of being, you know, part of the solar system's largest hot air balloon festival in a place where you don't even need a spacesuit. So, I mean, it's even more comfortable. It's the one place in the book where you don't need a spacesuit. And you've got those winds there that take you around in 80 hours. You know, you've got the clouds, you've got the sun. That sounds like fun to me.
Like you said before, very Jules Verne-ish. Well, our guest today has been John Moores. He is one of the authors of the book Daydreaming in the Solar System, Surfing Saturn's Rings, Golfing on the Moon, and Other Adventures in Space Exploration. John, thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio. It is a fun, fun read, and I highly recommend it for anybody who's ever wondered what it would be like to surf on the ring of Saturn.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW. You can find this episode on kpcw.org under the Shows tab or on the KPCW app or wherever you get your podcasts at KPCW Cool Science Radio. And if you liked today's episode, rate us, subscribe to the show, and share it with your friends.